Laird.com.
I'm John McChesney. This is The Connection. If you're anything like me, you know very little about classical music or Beethoven. You know, you're supposed to like it. Or frankly, my dear, you may not give a damn. But before you touch that tuner, stay with me. Give it another chance. I want to see if composer Robert Capello can really do what people say he can. That is, turn me on, and maybe you, to the music of Beethoven. Capello plays piano, composes, and conducts, recently the Philadelphia Orchestra and the New World Symphony. To send his message about classical music, he produces What Makes It Great, part of National Public Radio's Performance Today. He's been called a born teacher, a magician, a pied piper who converts the most reluctant listener. His claims are indeed lofty. I'm convinced, says Capello, that if you could change how America listens, you could change America. Connection listeners, can Beethoven change your life? 1-800-423-8255 is the Capello-Beethoven connection. 1-800-423-TALK, or you can join us online at theconnection.com. This could be called, this edition of The Connection could be called Beethoven for the Dummy, and in this case, I'm the dummy. Robert, we opened this show by saying that Beethoven was, in his era, the bad boy of music. Why was that?
Well, you know, I think it was kind of the pulp fiction of its time. Now this stuff has become mainstream music at Tanglewood. If you want to play something safe, you play Beethoven. Elevator music, even. But in its time, I mean, this was the kind of thing that let you run screaming from the hall. So my goal is to get you to run screaming from the studio by the end of the morning.
Probably wouldn't be too hard.
I mean, I think one of the reasons is that they had a set of expectations, and then somehow within those expectations, they were stunned by what happened. In the same way that when Pulp Fiction came out, you know, you sort of go to a movie and you think you know what you're going to see, and then something comes on the screen that's so wildly out of your experience. I had that experience with Crouching Tiger, too. I mean, you watch that first aerial sequence, and it's just so beyond any expectation you had. And this music was like that.
Unless you grew up on Superman.
Yeah, that's right. Superman without wires.
But is it just convention busting that made him the bad boy of music? Or was it something beyond convention busting? Anybody can be iconoclastic.
Exactly. That's a great point. I mean, wide ties of the 60s are surprising, but I don't think 200 years from now we'll be wearing wide ties. So I think you're right. It's not just a question of doing something that was a bad boy thing, but it's also of, in doing that, finding something that's so universal that even 200 years later today, the core of that message is still relevant.
So the core of that message.
Exactly. Couldn't be a better question. And I thought, what better to start with than probably the most famous notes in Beethoven and the most famous notes in music? Everyone knows the beginning of this piece. Let's hear it. Now, it doesn't get more famous than that. But
no, even I recognize.
Even you recognize the beginning of the Fifth Symphony. But, you know, though we know that, what actually makes it great? Why all the fuss? Why 200 years later should we be bothering with this? Now, don't touch that dial. Now, this piece starts off, and you get this incredibly dramatic thing. And then there's this great pause. I mean, pauses in Beethoven are fantastic. They're not just pauses for drama. They're pauses to say, take this in. Make this part of your consciousness. So what have you just heard? Three notes that are the same, and then another note. And plus, you've gotten this kind of elemental rhythm in your body. Short, 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 long. Okay, then you do it again like this. And already you've got, like, an idea. There are two things. Now, they are different in a way. They are different notes. Are different notes than these. But what's the same, John? The rhythm is the same. So that's your idea. Now, all of a sudden, it starts happening everywhere. It's like, imagine you're obsessed by some idea, and everywhere you look, you see it. You see it here. 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 Then you see it here. Now, what I want you to get is what you're actually seeing. All of those are the same because they're all three short notes that are repeated, and then something else. Three short notes, repeated, but they're all different. the important thing to get is for Beethoven, he's always looking beneath the surface. You asked what makes him more than just a bad boy. What he's looking for is what really connects us. You know, we may look different on the surface, Palestinian-Israeli, but what Beethoven is looking for is beneath those surface differences, what makes us the same. So at the beginning, we think we're all the same because we all have three notes and the same rhythm, which is the same as this, which is the same as this, which is the same as this. Now, AOL 6.0. You know, one of the things that's so interesting to me, I know that you're a technology person and I am myself, is how often you have something new. The pace of business change is staggering. You'll feel like you always have to come up with a new cell phone, 5.0, 6.0. But as you all know, there's really never anything different in the content. AOL 6.0 is really no different than AOL 5.0. But the pace of...
I'm glad you recognize that.
I mean, believe me, I just turned it on. But the pace of innovation is staggering. That sense that you always need something new. But it's nothing like the pace of innovation in Beethoven. Every piece of music really contains in it a philosophy of who you, the listener, are. Like, what kind of experience do you want? How much newness? How much repeat? How much you need to have the world confirmed? And all you've gotten so far in 4 seconds is already stunning information. There's this. There's this. Wait, now they can overlap. It's everywhere. Now, already the information is staggeringly new. Everything has been, how many repeated notes? 3, and then a change. Now, instead of going, which note changes? The third note changes. So he says, already we want AOL 6.1. So instead of, we do it like this. And then he says, wait a minute, wow, I'm going to do even something else. I'm going to add one more note to it. Now, that's already mind-blowing. So we've taken... and we've added it to... Now, that extra note is already a piece of information. Has now become... You get it twice. That's all you get it in Beethoven to know that it counts. And then the big climax of all is you add one more note. Part one of the demo. So I want you to get how Beethoven puts together his universe.
It also strikes me that it's very simple at
yes.
the outset. Incredibly simple.
And that's key. One of the things is people think classical music is so hard. It's not hard. If your ears are open, it's simple. All you've done is taken 4 notes, added one more, and then added one more. But one thing is, you know those buildings in the 60s where, like, the plumbing was supposed to show and, like, the surface was all this poured concrete? The whole idea
there are a couple of buildings just like that on the Berkeley campus.
Exactly. And the idea is the structure should show. He's not hiding anything here. This is not elegant stuff. You make ba-ba-ba-bum into ba-ba-ba-bum-bum. Then you make it into ba-ba-ba-bum-bum-bum. I will now solve the Mideast crisis for you. Now, this is the amazing moment, and if you get nothing else on this radio show but this, you'll get it. So you've gotten that ba-ba-ba-bum can become ba-ba-ba-bum-bum, and then finally becomes ba-ba-ba-bum-bum-bum. Now, get this in your ear. Get your ear around this. This is why people went nuts, ran out of the hall. This is why they didn't understand it, but this is why we're playing it 200 years later. Here it is. Get this in your ear. Later in the piece, he does this. Now, on the surface, that's completely different. If I were to look at the shape of those notes and you were to sing them as just notes, and they couldn't be more different. In Beethoven's universe, and this are the same thing. Now, they're the same thing because the rhythm is the same. If I were to clap them, the first one is ba-ba-ba-bum, bum, bum. The next one is ba-ba-ba-bum, bum, bum. On the surface, they could not look more different. Before Beethoven, people were said to be similar, like if their facial structure looked the same, their notes, like if your eyes, ears, nose, and mouth. What Beethoven is saying here is that's superficial. You are the same as me because we're both human beings. If we look beneath the surface of those notes, the rhythm is what keeps us together. And that's what this music is about. Relationship, finding that things that look different. And this are, if you look close enough for connection and essence, the same thing.
It's interesting to me that you keep using the visual metaphor. At the open, you said, when you see this, and then you're just saying, if you look at this,
yeah.
You're using a visual metaphor. I don't know whether it's because you're used to looking at music or whether you see music as you hear it.
Well, also, it's not only that. I mean, in a way, buildings are music. You know, people often talk about music as frozen architecture. And I see those kind of, like, you can see them as blocks. Here's a granite block, three blocks, ba-ba-ba-bum. Then I add another block to that picture, ba-ba-ba-bum-bum. I add another block, ba-ba-ba-bum-bum-bum. So I do see those visually. Also, I think certain people hear things, certain people see things. So I'll take whatever sense you've got that will actually make it work.
1-800-423-8255. We are going to take your calls, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's hear from Megan. Megan, welcome to The Connection.
Hi.
Hi, Megan.
Hi, I just had a comment. I was told once that the short, 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 long is Morse code for victory, and therefore the song was very popular during the World Wars.
Yes, you know, interesting thing about that is, though obviously the war was after the actual composition, generation after generation makes of this music what they need to make of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's not only just that it's short, 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 long, but there's some kind of human affirmation, a sense of struggle being overcome, that I think it was more than just the short, 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 long that turned it into the Morse code for victory. In the same way that, you know, when the Berlin Wall came down, they played Beethoven. And I think they played Beethoven because it's about that kind of connection. It's about seeing that we are all connected if we look only deeply enough. But that's a great point. You're right.
Beethoven was kind of a lefty, wasn't he?
I actually think that's true. You know, I mean, it's always about that. Can I play you just one more little excerpt from this piece?
Please do.
Because now that you've gotten so much of it, let's just hear, do we have a second drop in?
We have a couple of minutes here, so you have to stay within that.
Okay, here's, now you've got this expert thing here. You're experts on this. Now, can you hear that that's the same as this?
Mm-hmm.
Got that. Now, which note do I leave out? You are fantastic. So I leave one out. Now, I want you to get how Beethoven works with an idea. This is called getting to the core of the universe. I take this. Now, I leave out one note. Now, if I just concentrate on the fourth and fifth, and I go, wait a minute, what if I just paid attention to those two? And I did this. Now I start to see that everywhere. So I've now reduced the whole thing. Bum-bum-bum-bum-bum to just bum-bum. So now I've got this. I've got this. It's going by, just... Oh my. Okay. So, what you've had is... has just become... which becomes this. Now you start to see it everywhere. Always two of them. You start to see it here. Two more. Two more. Oh, my God. Where's it going? But it's always two more. Then here. Now, instead of this, I go. Then it's here. Now it's just one. And now it's just this. Now, that is unbelievable. What you've just gotten is this. Step by step has become this. A pulsing chord. That's what makes Beethoven great.
We're deconstructing Beethoven here on The Connection, 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection. I'm John McChesney. We're coming to you from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio.
Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up at noon on Here and Now, documents are being released pertaining to the murder investigation.
I'm John McChesney. This is The Connection. We're here deconstructing Beethoven with Robert Capello. Robert, we were working on Beethoven's fifth when we left. Are we coming back to that?
Thank you.
Robert Capello is with us. We're talking about Beethoven on The Connection. It's 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Robert, we were just listening to an excerpt there. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, it's funny. I feel like I should warn people, you know, in the Tolstoy novel, The Kreutzer Sonata, after hearing a performance of this, a husband murders his wife in brutal fashion. So I take no responsibility for anything that happens on the air when people hear that piece. But, you know, it's interesting that Tolstoy should pick this piece and really make this drama of violence and romance out of it, because this is truly radical music. You know, I think one of the things I really want to get across to people is this was so wild. It should never be listened to politely. In fact, in the Tolstoy novel, he says you should never play this for women with low-cut dresses in a party atmosphere. The music is just totally out of the ordinary sphere.
I'm told this is the first radical violin sonata.
Yes, and that's an eminent quote from Rob Capello. actually, that comes from, I don't know if you know the writer Milan Kundera. You know that movie they made, Unbearable Lightness of Being? And he has this other wonderful book called Testaments Betrayed. And he talks about Beethoven, because I don't know, many people didn't know he was actually a jazz musician and a very serious musician. And he talks about Beethoven's sort of legacy to future artists all the way up through the 20th century. And he says one of the legacies was, before Beethoven, you had kind of like standard procedures. You know, I think of like when you make a ER show on television or a hospital show or a cop show, they're standard procedures. There's things that they all do. We know what those formats are like, and you can make Gideon's Hope, and it's sort of the same format, and you just change the actual characters in it. What he said is before Beethoven, that's what it was like to write a piece of music. You had a kind of predetermined pattern, a fast first movement, slow second movement, you had a minuet, a fast, funny finale, and you sort of filled in the pre-existing form. He says what Beethoven did and his legacy to us all the way to the present is each piece had to be radically individual. Each piece had to literally invent itself and invent its form, and that becomes the topic of the piece. So this is a first radically individual sonata because it invents what a violin sonata is right before our very eyes.
From scratch?
From scratch. And not only from scratch. You know, it's interesting. The very beginning there is the first time in music history that a violin sonata began with four measures of the violin by itself. Simply never happened. It's like the pianist forgot to come in. And not only is it violin by itself, but it's some of the most awkward music to play. I mean, it makes violinists crazy to play this piece. I mean, it's nerve-wracking. You stand up there on the stage, nothing has happened, and you have to play this awkward beginning, which is really strained, difficult, and slow. And it's just a violinist's nightmare. But somehow, you know, so much of Beethoven is about nightmare. You know, you're playing something that's awkward for your instrument, violent, hard, louder. He was also, his music was noisier and more intense than anyone you can imagine. And I mean, you remember a few years ago, they had that Federal Express commercial where this guy talked incredibly fast. Mm-hmm. That's what Beethoven was like. Your worst dinner guest. No manners, fast talking, loud, shoe on the table. That's the kind of music that this is.
1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection. We're talking with David Capello about Beethoven. Let's go to the phones. David, you're on The Connection.
Hello, you're talking with Robert Capello, and this is David in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hello, Bob Capello, this is David Wright.
Hi, David.
I just got off a deadline with the Sunday New York Times writing about Yo-Yo Ma.
Uh-huh.
Now I'm feeling frisky, and I'm calling talk shows.
You must be feeling very frisky.
I better be careful what I say.
I called to talk about that Tolstoy story that you mentioned, mm-hmm. the Kreutzer Sonata, mm-hmm. and to take it one step further, and I think you know the step I mean, to Janáček and his first string quartet.
Uh-huh.
He based that quartet on his own life, as he did with so much of his music, and he read that Tolstoy story, and it reflected a similar love triangle in his own life. And so his string quartet number one is titled The Kreutzer Sonata. And there's not a note of Beethoven in it, but it is inspired by the Tolstoy story. So here you have an example of music influencing literature, which in turn influences music.
Well, you know, I think one of the great things about great music is that each generation finds in it what they need. You know, there's a wonderful quote from Stravinsky where he talks about tradition is a heritage that has to get passed on from generation to generation, but only on the condition that each generation first make it bear fruit. And that idea that you don't just pass it on by listening to Beethoven, but you make it bear fruit. You interact with it. You engage with it. So Tolstoy engages with it by creating his story. Janáček engages with it by commenting on a story and a piece of music. And in fact, today, that's exactly what we're doing. So I think the greatest pieces have somehow touched a resonant chord that each generation literally reinvents for themselves in the way they need it. And that's part of the power of this music.
1-800-423-8255. Amy is on the line from Burlington, Vermont. Amy, welcome to The Connection.
Hello.
Hi, Amy.
Thanks so much for talking about Beethoven. I'm so glad to hear, Mr. Capello. This is really fascinating. I had a question about when I think of the evolution of music over time, I think, you know, of Bach as being sort of the granddaddy of Baroque, and then I think of Mozart as really, you know, doing the classical revolution, and then there's Beethoven with the Romantics. And I'm wondering if you could speak to Beethoven's innovations in, you know, in the context of Bach and Mozart, who came before.
Yeah. I think one of the things about Beethoven is, first of all, it raises the whole kind of dramatic level of music, and it changes the interaction between you, the audience, and the composer. When you're in the world of Bach, still Bach is, in a way, a servant. He's a servant of the church, servant of the court, but clearly somebody else owns him. You move through the classic period, and in fact, if you read Haydn's contract at Esterhazy, it sounds like the contract still of a servant. I mean, they tell him what he has to wear, when he has to be at dinner, how much he has to plan. And then there's a famous quote about Beethoven, which I'm sure is not true, but like all apocryphal quotes, even though apocryphal, they get at a truth. And he says, "There will always be 1,000 princes. There will only be one Beethoven."
Huh.
And that idea that somehow now the artist is something special. He's no longer just providing entertainment. He's providing something significant. You, the audience, are now coming to witness me take my inner journey and tell you something profound, truly changes the nature of communication. When you're listening to that Kreutzer Sonata, or when you're listening to Beethoven, and you hear that moment where all of a sudden we're pulsing on one chord in the Fifth Symphony, and you're sitting there saying, "Oh my God, this has become this one soft chord. Oh my God, the whole universe is reduced to a single note. Everything is the same." I think that is a whole different kind of way that a concert is now being created, and a different purpose. The audience is now coming to get great truths from a musician who is plumbing his inner depths. The Heart of Darkness of Conrad really starts here at Beethoven, the idea that you travel through your own inner Nile River to get to your own inner truths that perhaps the audience themselves would not have done themselves. You share that inner truths, they come, and we are now in a serious communion business talking to each other about the most important things. So that's really the change in the relationship between the composer and the audience.
1-800-423-8255. We are talking to our audience as well as listening to Robert Capello take Beethoven apart for us and put it back together. Bruce is on the line. Bruce,
hi.
Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you. Yeah, I've always loved the Fifth, and I was listening to a show called Schickley's Mix. Yeah, and he had gotten a letter from some women who apparently felt that it was evocative of a male aggressiveness, and it was a sexist song. And I was wondering if you had ever heard this, and if you had, what your reaction to it was.
Well, you know, there's almost nothing that you haven't heard at some point about the Fifth Symphony, and I think that rather than the truth or the falseness of each individual comment, I think it's wonderful that it provokes so much. You know, in a way, great music is like a Rorschach blot in which, as I said earlier, each generation and each person sees what they see. I've often felt like when you go to a concert with 600 people in the audience, there are really 600 performances going on. And each person brings themselves and their experience to it and refracts what they're listening to through their own particular prism. So I think everyone has heard what they need to hear in it. I myself would not say that that's what I hear in it. I will say this, there's certainly an incredible, almost demonic intensity to the piece. That, by the way, is one of the things we've lost, that sense that this music is beyond the pale, so intense that it's actually almost beyond the bounds of decorum. So I do feel that there's that. I don't see it in any kind of sexist way. But again, everyone sees what they need to see in great music.
That's what the Fifth... I'm being cued a little bit here, but that's what the Fifth Symphony says. What about the Fifth Sonata?
The Fifth Piano Sonata, you mean? The Fifth Piano Sonata, the Appassionata, is similar. Again, this is kind of music that steers for the deep waters. You know, there's a phrase in Walt Whitman's Passage to India, and he talks about great art steering for the deep waters. And you hear the beginning of this piece, and it goes like this. Now, in and of itself, that's not so much. It's just three notes down, three notes up, the same three notes up.
Again, that simplicity.
Again, great point you just made, John. So much of Beethoven is constructed out of ordinary stuff. You know, we tend to think of art as coming from exalted surroundings. And people have often criticized Beethoven by saying he doesn't write beautiful melodies. He's not interested in that. He wants to start from, like, and the. The bedrock stuff of ordinary experience. So much of Beethoven is about, if we only look closely at the ordinary things, we'll see extraordinary things in them. So as you said, it doesn't get simpler than three up, and then a little close, and you know it's closing because there's a little trill. Now, here's ordinary, normal. This is back to Pulp Fiction, and also I'll tell you about coat hangers in hotel rooms in a minute. The normal hotel room goes from there to here. And that would be a normal continuation. Now get that in your ear. Here's the first. The normal place to go from there is here. Get that in your ear. Listen where Beethoven goes. Whoa, oh my, somewhere unheard of. We are in far territory. We have no idea where we are. And then the piece has to discuss where is that versus home. That's what I mean. It's always surprising, always steering for the deep waters.
Always, what you're talking about, though, constantly is the breaking of our expectation.
Right.
Our expectation built on convention that we've grown up with.
Right, exactly. You know, I often think about that. I spend a lot of my time in hotel rooms. And I don't know about you, but, you know, when
you... Unlucky you.
Yeah, no, in a way, it's fun because you really get expectations. Whenever you walk into a hotel room, your experience is based on all the other ones you've walked into. You know, recently I've begun to look at coat hangers. You know, if you go to these...
You must really be desperate.
No, it's fascinating. You go to these, the expensive hotels like the Ritz-Carlton, and I'm not being funded by them. You go to the Ritz-Carlton, and it's a normal coat hanger. And the message really is, this is an upper-class hotel. We would never dream that you would take the hangers. We just put them there. But, of course, we all know that you're going to take the hangers, so they raise your room rate to include the price of all the stolen hangers. If you go to a cheaper hotel, you know... They're honest. They say, we know you're going to take them, and they weld those coat hangers to the metal rod. No one can take them. But then a clever innovation like Beethoven. I went to one recently. The coat hanger was so tiny. In other words, they had a small dowel. So the coat hanger didn't need to be welded because the dowel was so irregular that even if you took the coat hanger, you couldn't use it anywhere else. That's a surprise because of the patterns that you've had.
I thought there was a musical point in there somewhere.
It's a point about patterns. We understand so much of experience because of our patterns. When we watch a movie, we know about how long it's going to be. You go to a James Bond movie, you witness it past all the other James Bond movies you've experienced. That's what I'm trying to get you into in the world of Beethoven.
Let's take a quick call from Fred. Fred, welcome to the Connection.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Question I had, and I don't know if I didn't know if this was based on a limited knowledge of Beethoven, but his use of bass in a lot of his pieces, it seems to be the type of recurring thing that he always brings you back to and uses a lot of heavy bass, so it's almost like his music is heavy, but not in the, you know, ponderous way, but, you know, it shakes you inside type of thing.
Yes, also, it's not only that. Beethoven's always looking for experience that, as John was saying, takes you outside the norm. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense that Beethoven often uses extremes of register, like really low notes and really
right.
high notes, because he wants to tell you something special. that's not ordinary. So you find this sense of primal beginnings down low in so much of Beethoven. In fact, the one we were just listening to in the Appassionata, the big key moment is something really down low in the bass, and it's a perfect lead, and I'll show you what just happened. You just had this little ending here. Now, I want you to get your mind around how Beethoven thinks, and you can do this for me, John. Now, you don't even have to know the name of a note. If I tell you this note is D-flat, you don't even have to know what that means.
I'll take your word.
That's D-flat. Now, what note do I finish on?
D-flat.
D-flat. Now, but for Beethoven, this is amazing. If I start here on D-flat and finish on D-flat, Beethoven says I could sum that up just like this. I've just summed up its essence. Now, let me follow the next step. If I start on C, what note do I finish on? C. Same thing. Now, get this. He sums that up as C. Now, watch this. This is amazing. This is worth the price of radio. If this is D flat, this is C, I can sum the two up like this in the bass. Which is exactly what Beethoven does in those primal regions down low.
It's amazing. We're talking to Robert Capello. He's deconstructing Beethoven for us, reconstructing and deconstructing. You're listening to The Connection. I'm John McChesney from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at Noon, the latest on the murder investigation of the two Dartmouth professors.
Innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm John McChesney. You're listening to The Connection. We're here with Robert Capello talking about Beethoven. And I want to ask you a question about, we've been talking a lot about convention and expectation and then the breaking of those expectations, which is what Beethoven was marvelous at. I was once on an assignment for National Public Radio in the country, the African country of Chad. I was out in the middle of the Sahel, in the middle of a famine, actually, and I was driving across the desert with some of my colleagues, and we had a Toyota Land Rover, and we were playing cassettes, and we were playing the Rolling Stones. But we had a driver who was a Goran tribesman, dressed in turban and toga, and he would then get tired, sick to death of the Rolling Stones, and would pop in some African music that none of us understood, could respond to at all. And he was sick of the Rolling Stones, we were sick of his music. Now, you're talking about music in a way here that builds on expectation, built on tradition. Is there any way that this kind of music crosses cultural boundaries? Is there a way that you could take that kind of music and make it explicable to someone who's just totally out of that musical tradition?
You know, that's a fantastic question. And I think about that a lot every time I watch cricket.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, we have a whole baseball tradition. And we understand when we grow up what's a good play in baseball. You know, what's a good double play? Did they turn it well? Yet when I watch cricket, I have absolutely no sense of what's a good play in cricket, what's a bad play in cricket. And when I listen to, for example, Indian ragas, it's often very hard. I think what you get in those cases is pretty much like what I get with cricket, which is if someone's a real personality, you get the kind of universal, he's coordinated or he's graceful. And in that music, if it's not your culture, you get sort of the raw gestures of it. You know, the sort of the big picture gestures, if something's virtuosic on a sitar, or if there's an incredible drum pattern in an African drum thing. I think you get that. But what you miss are all the nuances of meaning which come from it. It's fascinating that you should ask me this, because I just recently did a show for National Geographic Cable, and evidently Science Magazine has recently come up with a discovery by looking at whale songs, that in fact, whales construct their songs along the same musical principles as a Beethoven sonata or as a classical song. And their inference is that...
I'm sorry we don't have a whale song here, so
I
you
wish,
could do that.
Had I known you were going to ask me, I would have brought it along. But they actually claim that not only are these whale songs by the same patterns as music, but that if you're an expert, you can tell by listening to a whale song what part of the region of the world that whale song came from. And, like a wine, you can tell what year, because evidently the whales invent a different song each year, taking off from their previous year's song and varying it. So their inference is that perhaps universal grammar is actually music, that perhaps that is something universal. So
see, that's what I wondered about this, because it rattled my... I've often thought of music as being basically the only religion that I really have. And I've often thought how weird it is that these, what are basically mathematical algorithms... strike some sort of chord in a human being.
Right.
But when I was in that Land Rover and Chad, and we were so off base about each other's music, I thought, well, there's not some universal algorithm here. It's really something very different for different cultures.
Well, let me give you a thought on it. Joseph Campbell, I don't know if you know his writings on mythology, and did that wonderful series with Bill Moyers. He has often said that there are, in every, throughout cultures, he's often been struck that there are a few universal ideas. And it seems that each culture has to tell these same universal ideas over and over again. In the world of myth, it's stories about virgin births, death and resurrections, creation myths, that there are a few stories that all cultures tell. Yet each culture seems to tell it in their own local language, you know, in the language of the culture of that time. That in the best works, you're telling something universal in a local language. We may lose the meaning of the local language. Like everyone who listens to Shakespeare, you often need footnotes to understand the local references to bodkins and things like that. Yet even though you miss some of the local telling of it, you get at the universal. So that's what I think. There's a sense in which, yes, we lose some of the nuances of the raga or the African, but yet there's something behind it that I bet you did get if you listened. If you could just open your ears for a while, you might not get every cultural meaning, but you'll get that primal rhythmic drumming pattern, change of pattern, and it just takes a while to open your ears to get inside the pattern.
1-800-423-8255. We're talking with Robert Capello about music, and specifically about Beethoven. Mark, you're on the line. You're going to talk about another musician, I think.
Hello, yes.
Hi, Mark.
Hi there. Listen, this is great. I mean, we could go on for hours on this. Beethoven is one of my favorites, and I've always been convinced that he was reincarnated as Thelonious Monk.
Uh-huh.
Aside from the, you know, the bad boy... Breaking the rules, becoming mainstream after a while. You know, everyone, when Monk was first playing, thought the guy was nuts.
Right.
And they did go run, you know, screaming from the room.
Right.
Well, sort of. But now everyone realizes how brilliant he was. And fortunately, we haven't heard any of his music in the supermarkets yet. But,
oh, I'm sure there's arrangements of Round Midnight for soft strings.
Or that Mysterioso.
That are in Gristidis if you listen close enough.
It's funny, you know, you talk about arrangements. You just played the second movement from the Moonlight. Uh-huh. And I actually have a jazz quintet, and I just did an arrangement of that for them.
Uh-huh.
Just because I was listening to the melody... man, and that's a gorgeous melody.
Oh, absolutely.
And you were talking about how people don't think of Beethoven as writing great melodies,
right.
But listen to a melody like that,
right.
And then listen to, for example, Thelonious Monk's Ugly Beauty, which is obviously in the same key. Yeah. It's stunning. You know, Monk wrote absolutely gorgeous, elegant melodies just like Beethoven did, but they also wrote some crazy stuff with rhythmic... explosion and space and pause, and you never know what's going to happen next, except they also, the way you're talking about with Beethoven's four notes before on the Fifth Symphony, you know, Monk did a lot of the same thing. He would just take a little snippet of a melody, and he would improvise three or four choruses based on, you know, just a couple of notes out of the melody, if you know the song.
Like Mysterioso.
Yeah, and I think, you know, yeah. One of the things that all these great composers have in common, and which is one of the reasons why we listen to them, whether it's Thelonious Monk or Beethoven, is that they listen for possibilities in the smallest things. You know, they listen for a note here, a note there. So much of great art is about noticing something that otherwise we wouldn't have noticed and seeing how much you can make out of so little. So, you know, for Monk it may be... And then the whole thing grows out of that. But I think what's great is these great composers pay attention, particularly in an internet world where we are so inundated with information. They look at a small thing And they look closely at that small thing. And the message is really always, if you look closely at the smallest thing in front of your nose, you can see the whole world. You know, the Buddhists are always saying, if you look in the palm of your hand, you can see the world. And I really believe that that's what this great music is about. If you look closely at just three notes, a short and a long, if you look at a little fragment of a blues, in fact, if you even just look at the 12 bars of a blues, you can see the whole universe. And that's one of the things. Great art makes you stop, pay attention, and see how rich the world is in front of you if you only look.
1-800-423-8255. Mark, thanks for your call. Tim, you're on the line. I think you might help us turn the corner to another piece of music.
Hi.
Hi.
I wonder if you could just say a few words about the sixth, the pastoral movement of the sixth, sure. And maybe a little bit about the ninth.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
My favorite pieces.
We could say anything about anything. You know, it's interestingly, you know, there's so many great things to say about the pastoral symphony, but one of the moments that's always interested me the most, because it sort of presages minimalism, I think Philip Glass comes out of it. And again, it's back to that same point. There's a moment in the sixth symphony where you're walking through the forest, and you just get the same thing over and over again. I mean, it just repeats over and over again. In fact, you can't believe how annoying it is to just, you know, again, that's what I mean by switching the role from servant to master. Haydn would never insist, I'm going to repeat it whether you like it or not. Beethoven says you're going to hear it over and over again. Over and over. Again, again. You just sit there. But then there's this incredible moment where the sun comes through the forest and it's suddenly, and you are literally stunned by the breathtaking beauty of it. But it's only so beautiful because you've sat there. So the change is just exquisite. And I think that, to me, is the essence of the pastoral symphony. And once again, it's that new relationship of a composer to the audience. I'm going to sit here as long as I need to sit here. And then when I change, it is ravishing beauty.
Tim brought up the ninth, and we have the ninth, I think, here that we're going to do a little exercise with.
So. Well, it's a great way to end. And I think, you know, what I wanted to take the most famous tune that everyone knows from Beethoven, the Ode to Joy. And once again, it's also back to that earlier comment about things that are low. When this tune starts, it starts pre-music. You know, unlike Mozart, who even in the simplest version of a tune, it was already the most exquisite jewel box you could ever buy from Tiffany's, Beethoven is willing to start at these kind of primordial pre-levels. You know, when you hear that tune at first, there's no harmony. It's down low, like that caller said, in the double basses and cellos, and it just sits there. And it will seem like it's the longest, ugliest tune you can possibly imagine. It will seem like it has no possibility. Why did this even belong in a symphony? And I want you to feel that sense of, it's ugly, it's boring, it's long, it's repetitive. Why am I listening to this? Again, Beethoven willing you to start from the lowest level. Then gradually, they'll add harmony to it. And each variation isn't so much like a variation, like we all know what variations are. It's you're literally building up a cosmos from nothing. Then you add one level. Then finally, when the strings come in, he made 120 sketches of this. I mean, that somehow makes me feel better. But listen to this. This isn't music. This is pre-music. It's like down low. Nothing is happening. No harmony. Part two couldn't be clearer. My son could have written this. Repeats. One great note here. Now watch how you feel when it repeats. You already get this. It repeats. You can't believe it. Now, this seems endless, but it's shorter than New York, New York, or any pop song. We do it. But nothing is happening. You're thinking, what's this going to turn into? Now listen when you add something to it on top. This isn't just variation. This is a world opening up in front of your very eyes. But it's the same tune. Who dreamed that this person we knew nothing about could contain this? Here's our syncopation. Listen, a little bassoon. And it repeats the middle. Still, it's not a complete world. You're watching a cosmos. This is what I mean, a piece generating its own world in front of your very eyes. Now the one he wrote 125 times. Listen to this, it's gorgeous. The is growing in front of your eyes. But this came from nothing, remember? Each level is pushing the expression one step further. I'm offering you more of myself. This is personal music. But there's more to go, we feel. We're only strings. We need more. The whole world has to participate in this piece. Now what? We repeat one more time. We feel the urge. We can already feel it. This is music for the whole world. And you'll feel it come in. And finally, everyone joins. And the voices only come in later. Again, it's not like I'll add voices later. It's finally, the world has to include song. The first time in a symphony, voices come in. But this is what I mean by someone literally inventing a cosmos in front of your very eyes. From nothing down low, building, 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 until you have the biggest human community in a piece of music ever created.
The biggest human community.
Right. And that's what makes Beethoven great. It's about the largest community. And you know what? 200 years later, it's still about that. And every time you hear that music, you feel there's room in it for everyone in the world.
Robert Capello, thanks you. Thank you so much. This was really a terrific hour.
Thank you.
I learned a little bit here, which I was supposed to.
I apologize.
I hope our listeners did. Thanks for coming in. Connection listeners, if you're in the Boston area on Friday, that's tomorrow night, Robert Capello will be performing his What Makes It Great program at Jordan Hall at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. I'm John McChesney, and this is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.